Now that we're afternoon here, so we're transitioning from the morning part of the section, at least in the Eastern time zone, to the afternoon time. And it's a pleasure to welcome back. We're not really doing introductions, but Professor Daniel R. Schwartz, who spoke a couple of years back. He is the Herbst Professor Emeritus of Judaic Studies at Hebrew University. He's been living in Israel for 52 years, if I'm not mistaken. So really, that's a tremendous milestone. And of our 10 speakers, they 7 of them are living in Israel. And that's, I think, to me also very important. And it shows where the center of Jewish life is. Okay, Bakasha, Professor Schwartz, you got your full 29 minutes.
Thank you very much. Okay. So happy to be here. And I hope everything will be clear enough. I'm going to be speaking basically about one word and where it will take us in examining the Osmonians' notions of who they were and what their struggle was about. And let me see if I can move to the next slide. Yes. We're going to be talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and how he was thought of by the Hasmoneans. And just to touch bases, who he was a Seleucid king, a king of the kingdom north of Eretz Yisrael, which was ruling Eretz Yisrael in antiquity. He was the king from 175 BCE. He had his dealings with the Romans, dealings with the Egyptians. Beginning in 168 BCE, for whatever reason, he was persecuting the Jews and Judaism, especially in Jerusalem, but also elsewhere in Judea. He died late in 164 BCE when he was in a campaign off in the east in Mesopotamia. And that was just about the exact same time that Judah Maccabee, who had been leading a rebellion against him in Judea, retook Jerusalem and restored the temple late in 164 BCE, namely in December, Hanukkah, Kislev of that year. You have a coin of his. If you want to read the Greek, you have the word Epiphanus going down the left-hand side of the coin. We're going to be talking about two very different books. And if nothing else comes from a lecture like this, then that people realize that there is no such thing as the Book of Maccabees, but rather there's the first Book of Maccabees and the second Book of Maccabees. So that might be enough to have us profit from a lecture like this. Two books have come down as part of the Catholic Bible or the Protestant Apocrypha, having originally been in the Greek Septuagint of the Holy Scriptures. One of them is First Maccabees, and it was originally in Hebrew, but survives only in that Greek translation. It's a book from Judea. It was in Hebrew. It's oriented around the state, and it's about how the Hasmoneans defeated the Greeks, which is one basic story of Hanukkah. There was a war, and the Hasmoneans defeated the Greeks and set up the Hasmonean kingdom instead of the Seleucid rule in Judea. The other one is the second book of Maccabees, was originally written in Greek and survives in Greek. It was written in the diaspora, probably in Egypt, and it's religion-oriented. It tells another story. It tells about how Jews who were persecuted remained faithful to Judaism, and eventually God allowed them through his providence to have their victories and to see the restoration of Judaism. They're two very different stories. And I want to talk about one particular word, which I have here in red, in 1 Maccabees chapter 1. 1 Maccabees chapter 1 tells the background of the Hasmonean revolt. It starts off talking about things in 170 BCE, when Antiochus had set up his kingdom in Syria. It says in verse 16, he wanted to be king of Egypt as well. He invaded Egypt. He wages war in Egypt. He's pretty successful in Egypt. In verse 19, he took the fortified cities of the land of Egypt and despoiled the land of Egypt. And coming back then, after that first campaign against Egypt, then Antiochus turned back after smiting Egypt in the 143rd year of the Seleucid era, which is what we call 169 BCE. And he came up against Israel and Jerusalem with a strong army. He invaded the temple arrogantly and took the golden altar and the candelabrum and all its appurtenances and the table of presents and the libation cups and the bowls and the golden censers and the curtain and the crowns and the golden decoration upon the facade of the sanctuary. He stripped them all off and he took the silver and the gold and the precious vessels and he took the hidden things that he found. After taking it all, he departed for his own land. He did phonoktonia is the Greek word. And spoke with great arrogance. That's basically what's said. A lot of details about what he took. You might note along the way that nothing is said about why he did this. It says he invaded Egypt because he wanted to be king of both kingdoms, which is not a great reason. And about doing all these things in Jerusalem, nothing is said at all. So he was arrogant and he took what he wanted to take. And after taking it all, he departed for his own land. He did phonoktonia and spoke with great arrogance. If you look at the etymology of the word phonoktonia, you'll see it's built out of two Greek roots, one that means murder and one that means kill. So it's sort of murderous killing, bloody killing, massacring. The standard Christian translation of the Bible, the Revised Standard Version, says he committed deeds of murder. He did phonoktonia, so he did something which was murderous killing, but he committed deeds of murder. It's a very reasonable translation according to the etymology of the word. A more scholarly translation of the last several years says he carried out murders and spoke with great arrogance. One way or the other, it's referring to Antiochus as having committed a lot of murder. If you translate that way, however, there's something of a problem here. Why are deeds of murder mentioned only after Antiochus left for Syria? This is the passage. Look at it again. After he takes all of these things in Jerusalem, in verse 24, he departed for his own land. He did phonoktonia, and he spoke with great arrogance. If we're referring to the murder of Jews or Judeans, that should have been mentioned before he left. If we're speaking of the murder of Syrians in his own land, the question arises why the author of 1 Maccabees would know about that or care about that. It's possible to answer it, but it seems like it's out of place to mention it there. And there's another issue as well. It's somewhat disproportionate. It's bad values to mention the murder of people after you mention the theft of all sorts of property. I was in Basel once in Switzerland when an article appeared in the newspaper that reported a tram collision. And as a result of the collision, the tracks were broken to some extent. The train was damaged to some extent. There was a delay in the whole system for several minutes. And in the paragraph after that, it said, and several people were seriously injured. And I thought that was no way to write an article in a newspaper. You should start off with the people who were hurt. Similarly here in 1 Maccabees, it's not really the way one should write about such things. And when you look at it, you can see that many scholars have noticed this problem. The text in the Greek is very simple Greek. It should be easy to translate it. And nevertheless, lots of scholars who have translated the text from the Greek, excuse me, have deviated from the plain translation. So you have some people, I give you an example in A in Kahana, they translate the text as it is, but they have a footnote which says that the word is out of order. Shouldn't be there. So they tell the readers we've got a problem. Some translators go even further and they simply leave the word out. So they're so bothered by it that they leave it out. Some translators change the order of the words in the text. So even though the text is written the way we saw it before, they will put the deeds of murder before he leaves, and that solves the problem wonderfully, except it doesn't correspond to what the Greek text says. A more elegant way of doing that is to leave the words in order, but instead of translating the verb with a simple past tense, you translate it with a past participle. He left having committed massacres, is what various translators have done. So they put the activity before his departure, even though it's mentioned after his departure. A major problem with that is there's no good way to do that in ancient Hebrew. And this text, which we have, is a translation from the ancient Hebrew. There's another translation I found that simply puts in before or prior to say he left, but before that, he did something else. Before he left, he worked a blood bath. And finally, one of the more radical solutions, there's at least one translation out there, which is the major church translation into German, which simply puts additional actors into the story. It says, he committed deeds of murder, having sent back all of this property with other people who left. that resolves the problem wonderfully, except it, again, it has nothing to do with the Greek text as we have it. So I looked at all of these scholars who have translated the text in surprising ways, and I take them to confirm my impression that the text is really problematic. There's really some problem raised by the text as we have it. But on the other hand, I'm not at all happy with any of their solutions because they are so violent towards the Greek text as it survives. This is not a proper way of translating a text. Could do better. And what I now suggest to you is that we realize that all of these suggestions are based on the etymological meaning of phonoktonia. Phonos meaning murder, kton being a root which refers to killing. But the fact is that it's not always the case that the way we use words corresponds to their etymology. Sometimes words have meanings of their own. I referred here to two articles I wrote about this some years ago. What they have to do, the point of departure is what's called the etymological fallacy. You shouldn't base everything on etymology. The way this inquiry began as I was teaching a class once with graduate students reading First Maccabees, and most of them use a middle-sized Greek dictionary. And when we got to this word, they all reported that the word doesn't appear in their dictionary, which means it's a fairly rare word in Greek. As a matter of fact, it appears only in a very large Greek dictionary. Those of you who I'm talking about, the large little Scott Jones dictionary, it does indeed have an article on this word and refers only to the Septuagint, indeed only to our passage, which means that the serious scholars who put together the huge dictionary of ancient Greek found this word only in our passage. That means it's a word the Jews used for their purposes. But there is a little bit more evidence for the cognate verb. We're talking about phonoktonia, but the verb is phonoktoneo, which means to do phonoktonia. And it's used in the Greek Bible to translate the Hebrew root phanaf, chet nun fe. Now, those of you who know the root probably know it only in its, or mostly in its usage in modern Hebrew, which is to flatter somebody. To flatter is a sort of a misuse of words. But in biblical Hebrew, actually, the root has to do with pollution. I give you the passages here, both in Numbers 35 and in Psalm 106. The verb is used with reference to polluting the land by spilling blood on the land. The notion is that if you kill somebody, the blood is spilled on the ground, and somebody has to do something about that in order to atone for this pollution which has been done to the land. And as it says in Numbers, blood will otherwise pollute the land unless you do what has to be done to atone for that, which usually, in the case of a regular murder, has to do with punish the murderer. So we see that Jewish translators of the Bible from Hebrew into Greek use the verb phonoktoneo to represent doing something polluting. In our text, we don't need a verb, we need a noun, because it says he did phonoktonia, but the noun should be a cognate noun. Let's hypothesize that the original Hebrew of 1 Maccabees 1:24 said that Antiochus did Hebrew choneth. Just returning here for a minute, made a little progress in verse 24. After taking it all, he departed for his own land. He did choneth, I now suggest, and spoke with great arrogance. Now, the question is, well, what does this do for the issue with which we began? And I'll say, first of all, it alleviates or even solves the original problem. Because if you say, after talking about all the stuff that he stole from the temple, if you say he did pollution and spoke with great arrogance, well, we don't have him doing specifically murder. We don't have our problems. He's doing pollution, spoke with great arrogance. It simply means he's misbehaving. He's doing terrible things, but doesn't particularly have to do with murder, which is what caused us our problems. But there's more here. And this is something which happens frequently in this type of work on the reconstruction of an ancient Hebrew text through its translation. Once you have a hypothesis about a Hebrew word which was used in the original, it can be worthwhile, especially if it's a rare word, to see where else the word appears in ancient Hebrew texts, especially in the Bible. In other words, it may be, it doesn't have to be, but it may be that when somebody uses a rare word, they're ringing a bell. They're reminding us, ah, yes, of some other context in which the word appears. And in this case, when you start looking for that, basically you say bingo. Because the word chonef, which is what we've hypothetically reconstructed here, appears in the Hebrew Bible only once. But it appears in a passage which contrasts a bad king to a righteous king. Namely, in Isaiah 32, you have several verses which begin with talking about a righteous king. Hein l'tzedek yimloch melech. Behold, a king will reign in righteousness, and princes will rule in justice. And after a couple of verses, it starts contrasting him with the evil kings who are out there now. So he's looking forward to the future when there'll be a righteous king. He's complaining about the current king who is evil. And the word he uses for evil is naval. So I italicize the word naval. And what do we read about naval? The naval will no longer be called noble, nor the knave said to be honorable. For the naval speaks nivala. Whatever naval means, nivala is the type of things a naval will say. And his mind plots iniquity. So we see it's bad things. To practice ungodliness, la'asot chonef, and to utter error concerning the Lord. And here we have particularly, look at the end, la'asot chonef, u'daber al Hashem to'a, which means in English that the Naval king does chonef, and he also speaks wrongly about God. If you read that, you say, oh, the two things which are predicated of Antiochus in verse 24 is he did chonef and he spoke with great arrogance. And you say, oh, we now see that the author is using the rare word which points us to verse to chapter 32 of Isaiah, and that verse says two things about the bad king, namely, La'asot chonef u'daber Hashem to'a. He speaks, translated here, to practice ungodliness or pollution, and to utter error concerning the Lord. Which means then that we can guess that the author of First Maccabees is taking it for granted that we know that Antiochus is a Naval. He's the Naval kind of king, and when you read our description of him in First Maccabees 1:24, you're supposed to think, ah, you mean to say he's a Naval. Now we ask, what does Naval mean? I refer here to two standard tools. BDB is a standard Brown Driver Biggs Bible Dictionary of Hebrew. It means foolish. It also means senseless, especially of the man who has no perception of ethical and religious claims and with the collateral idea of ignoble or disgraceful. In other words, someplace between foolish and evil. The guy is so foolish he doesn't know how he should behave. Evan Shoshan, who's a Hebrew lexicographer, in his concordance of the Bible, he goes even further. He simply defines it as shafal midot, ish b'riyal, person of shafal midot, a person of low moral character, a person who is wicked. Which means that if people who are reading First Maccabees chapter 1 picked up the allusion to Isaiah 32, they realize that the author has chosen an elegant way of saying of Antiochus that he's a Naval, which means one way or the other, whichever translation you want here, is a very nasty condemnation of Antiochus. So, as I just said, the verse assumes readers will realize he condemns him as a Naval, who is the opposite of a just king. Now I go further. Turns out that this notion that Antiochus was to be thought of as a Naval according to a biblical model is supported by the fact that 2 Maccabees does too, as I will now show you. So it must have been current among Jews of the 2nd century BCE when both of these books were written. I also give you an asterisk. Also in Daniel chapter 11, which is another book from the same period of time, we have a reference to Antiochus doing Yachnif, which sounds like it's a reference to the same complex of ideas, but I'm not going to pursue that. What is important, that 2 Maccabees, however, when looking for a model of the Naval, doesn't think of Isaiah, but rather it points to Ha'azinu, to Deuteronomy 32. Because there's ample evidence that Deuteronomy 32 is basically the structure, it's the underpinning of the entire story of 2 Maccabees, not 1 Maccabees. The story of 2 Maccabees is one of God who protects his covenantal partners. Chapter 3 gives you a booming example of that, until they sin, as they do in chapter 4, and then the author warns us this sin will not go without punishment, whereupon God hides his face, literally, in chapter 5, and therefore they suffer at the hands of a wicked king, Antiochus, chapters 5 and 6. Until the spilt blood of martyrs, chapter 6 and 7, the woman and her 7 sons, Eleazar, the old man, they're all killed terribly, and the author says, this all atoned for their sin. He compares the spilling of their blood to a sacrifice, and this all conciliates God. It reestablishes good relations between the Jews and God. And he then steps into the story. His wrath has turned to mercy, as it says in chapter 8, and he crushes the Jews' enemies one after the other, especially Antiochus, after that Antiochus' son. And eventually at the end of the book in chapter 15, he crushes Nicanor as well. And all through the book, there are allusions, there are echoes to verses from 2 Maccabees, verses in Deuteronomy 32. And I give you some references here. Deuteronomy chapter 2 Maccabees 7, 6 cites Deuteronomy 32, 36 literally. Chapter 5 talks about the hiding of God's face and about the arrogant foreigner who doesn't understand that he's successful against the Jews, not because he's so heroic, but because God's letting him do it. Chapter 5 has an echo of Deuteronomy 32, 25. Chapter 7, 33 and 8, 29 talk, echo literally, Va'al Avadav Yit Necham, which you have in Ha'azinu, that God eventually will become conciliated servants. And who is it who is doing the bad things to the Jews according to Deuteronomy 32? It is the people or the nation, which is a Naval. God says, they made me jealous by worshiping a God who's no God. They provoked me with their idols. I will, in return, tit for tat, stir them to jealousy with those who are no people. I will provoke them with a Naval nation. But obviously, nations have their kings, and the nation is a nation of which is Naval, that king will be a Naval as well. Which means, first of all, there's no need to amend the text of 1 Maccabees 1:24 or to deviate from a plain translation. What you have to do is not translate etymologically, but rather according to the way ancient Hebrew writers spoke about Chonef, and the way ancient Hebrew, Jewish translators translated Chonef into phonoktonia. Which makes us realize that Jews of the Hasmonean period understood their suffering under Antiochus in light of the biblical model of a Naval king. For 1 Maccabees, which is the Hasmonean's court history, it's just the story of a wicked foreign king. Remember, there was no reason why he attacked Jerusalem. He just attacked Jerusalem because he was arrogant. He's wicked, he's attacking the Jews, and he's opposed by heroic Jews, the Hasmoneans, who show up in the next chapter, beginning with Mattathias. They're smart, they're courageous, they're willing to invest all of their efforts in defending the Jews, and they successfully do it. And that's why they're entitled to rule the Jews in the end, because they earned it. There's nothing at all in 1 Maccabees to suggest that it was the Jews' sins that brought on their suffering, just like there's nothing in Isaiah 32 5:6 suggests that the king who is Naval does his wicked things because the people to whom he's doing it deserve it. He's simply wicked. There's no indication or hint in 1 Maccabees that atonement was needed in order to improve the Jews' situation. As a matter of fact, God is not mentioned in the entire book. Neither Theos, you know, from theology, nor Kyrios. There's no mention of God in the entire book of Maccabees. The Naval who persecutes the Jews is simply wicked, and he has to be overcome by Hasmonean power, and the book is all about that. I told you it's a state-oriented book. 2 Maccabees, in contrast, which is a book about Judaism, the word appears for the first time in history in 2 Maccabees to describe what it is the Jews are fighting for. It tells a story about sin, which is followed by God's hiding his face, Hester Panim like Naazinu, and that allows Antiochus to persecute the Jews, even though he's so arrogant he doesn't understand why he's doing it. And that's followed by atonement, and that's followed by reconciliation, and eventually by restoration. The Naval who persecutes the Jews is doing God's work, and as a Naazinu, what eventually stops him is the Jews' atonement for their sins, which allows God to resume his providential protection of them. So I revert to where I began, and I'll tell you these are two very different books, and now I will say that one of them, 1 Maccabees, I would call a Judean book. It's about the Judean state and those who rule it by defeating a foreign ruler. And the other one is a Jewish book, which tells a story which has to do with Judaism. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Always. 2 minutes, I think, if there are questions or comments.
Yeah, if anybody has any questions, comments, but just before, so of course, when they spoke last time, Professor Schwartz gave a series on anti-Semitism, and he always shows how one word, you know, you understand one word properly, it explains your whole meaning, how everything works. That's a real, real scholar's, a real, real beautiful approach. Okay, anybody have any quick questions? Just unmute yourself and ask.
I'll stop share so I can see more.
But very quickly, we're going to get back to the sketch. Okay, anybody? Otherwise, we'll take a 45-second break and have Professor Lukshin join us. By the way, I want to thank, he was the one who introduced me to Professor Schwartz. He was the one who suggested a few years ago, asked him to speak. So Marty, thank you for that. Okay, I think somebody has a quick
question. I have a quick question. In the Catholic Bible, both Maccabees 1 and 2 are part of their Bible?
Yes, they're part of the Bible, part of sacred scriptures.
Okay, thank you.
In the Reformation, the Protestants got rid of the books which were not part of the Hebrew Bible and are part of the Catholic Bible. They put them in the Apocrypha.
Thank you.
And why did we not take in either of these books? Because it was after the codification?
One reason is a formal reason rabbis give you is that after the Persian period, after the Nevi'im Achronim, there was no Holy Spirit, so they can't have books in the canon. But I think that if you look at 1 Maccabees, no spokesman of Judaism would imagine putting a book like that into the Bible. And 2 Maccabees was in Greek, and we don't have any books that aren't in Hebrew or Aramaic, at least, in our Bible. 2 Maccabees, I think, from the point of view, its contents could go straight into the Hebrew Bible, but it's in Greek. So it's a Jewish book. It's not a biblical book.
Okay.